Your committee will come to order. Chair recognizes the quorum. Do you want to do minutes now?
No.
Okay. All right. First bill up will be House File 2455, Representative Hillstrom, Court Reported Provisions Modified. Representative Hillstrom, you have an amendment to this bill, an author's amendment labeled A14.
Mr. Chair, thank you. We're going to hear the bill, take the public testimony, let folks know that there is a potential amendment. We're going to be laying this over for possible inclusion if we have a judiciary policy bill. So at this point, we won't be voting on that. So I don't really want to offer that amendment. I just want to present the bill, take public testimony, and then we'll lay it over.
I get it. Thank you. Proceed, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Come on down. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill was brought to me by the court reporters, and so I'd like them to come down and talk to you about the proposal. Get a chair.
Please take a seat, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson, and one of my clients is the Minnesota Association of Verbatim Captioners and Reporters, which is a long name for saying court reporters, but our professional association includes both official court reporters that serve in the courtrooms across our state and freelance reporters who generally work in the civil law area taking depositions, testimony, and the official record. They are an impartial keeper of the judicial record. I have two reporters with me, Joe Garrison from Ramsey County and Jan Ballman, who is a principal at Paradigm Reporting. They're going to walk through their respective sections of the bill and then happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Who's going to proceed first?
Why don't we have Jill go first?
Great.
Those are the first
Ms.
sections.
Ms. Garrison, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jill Garrison. I'm an official court reporter for a judge here in St. Paul in the 2nd Judicial District. We brought this language to your attention because it fit in nicely with the unsession. I'm not sure how old this statute is, but I've been working in Ramsey County for over 30 years, and it was drafted probably decades before I started there. A lot of the language is just so outdated that there are aspects of it that aren't even used or followed. And there are probably some judges that are unaware of some of the requirements. So we wanted to clean that up. And Section 1, I'm assuming that you have the information before you. It requires that the court reporter that's hired file a $2,000 bond. I started in 1983, and that I was not required to do that, and I'm sure anyone since has not. And so I think that we could probably strike that and clean up the language by getting rid of that. Same with the second section. At this time, the judicial council is the policymaker for the courts. They set our salary rates, benefits, that kind of thing. The court reporters also have a collective bargaining agreement with Teamsters, and state court administration and Teamsters sets our employment as the terms of our employment, and the statute doesn't reflect that either, and I think that we should clean that up. The third section, the transcript charges. As I said, I don't know how old this is. If it dates back to maybe 1950 or 1960, the transcript rates that are shown in the statute are so outdated, it's almost funny. And there have been court reporters who have been questioned by lawyers as to why they're charging the rate they're charging as opposed to the rate that's set in the statute. Judicial counsel sets that rate, at least for official court reporters. And we are to follow the rates per the policies set by judicial counsel. And the rate that is in the statute is inconsistent with our employer's policy. So we would like to clean that up. The fourth item, I think,
yep,
Ms. Jan will speak on.
Good afternoon. My name is Jan Ballman, and I'm a court reporter
For the last 33 years, I have a small company. We have offices in both downtown Minneapolis and downtown St. Paul. And I was involved a number of years ago, maybe 15 years ago, in getting the law that we currently have on the books in place. And this amendment just seeks to strengthen some of the language. Basically, I'm an outside of the courtroom. Jill does her job inside of the courtroom, and I take testimony outside of the courtroom, but our roles are the same. We need to be perceived by the public, and we need to be independent officers of the court. And this, there are 29 other states that have some sort of law that either prohibits or surrounds court reporters having contracts with parties to the lawsuit. So currently, our bill allows for that as long as the law allows for that, as long as this arrangement is disclosed to the parties. And what we're looking to do here in Section 4 is strengthen the requirement for disclosing contracts and the charging of equal fees to both parties. Currently, there is a shifting of those discounts from the party. Oftentimes, it's a large corporation, maybe an insurance company, to the other party. This is what is allowing for the discount to happen in the first place. So what we're asking for in terms of strengthening this bill is that not only that it continues to be disclosed in writing, but also at the time of the deposition that the fees that are being charged to both parties are disclosed at that time. And then as well, we'd like to add allowing a provision for the presiding officer to order a remedy. Currently, the bill just says that if disclosure fails to happen, the transcript that just had been taken may be null and void. And this allows the presiding officer to offer other options that are discretionary in terms of remedies if this law is not, there's a violation of this provision. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Ballman. Questions from members?
And Mr. Chairman, there's just one last section to the bill, Section 6.
Okay, Mr. Carlson?
And that just repeals a never-used requirement that would require official court reporters to disclose their outside transcript income to court administration. It's, I don't think, been done for years, and just wanted to point that out. There is a repealer in the bill as well.
Again, that's...
Thank you, Ms. Gerson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that is another section that it's in the statute, but it's never been followed, or at least not in the last 25, 30 years it hasn't been followed. I know I've heard of it. I remember hearing about this when I was first employed, first hired, but I don't know that our district administrator, and I've checked around the state, other district administrators as well are not requiring this to be followed, and it hasn't been followed for at least 20, 25 years. And so that is another section that we would like to repeal simply because it's ineffective and not being used.
Well, Ms. Gerson, frankly, that surprises me. I've never heard of an agency not following a law that we pass around here. Could this fairly be characterized as an unsession agenda topic, Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It fits very nicely into the unsession.
Perfect.
Topic.
Thank you. Any other questions from members regarding? Oh, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair, you raised the same question I did. In several areas, I've noticed the court is not following the law of all entities. Why? How did this happen? How do we get there?
Ms. Garrison?
I'm not sure how we get there, except that now, you know, we used to be operated, each district and each county operated their own court system, and then we became one big happy family. We're now one big statewide system. And in the 90s, the Conference of Chief Judges was put in place, and so the chief judge of each district then would meet and they started to set the policies. Later, as we all became one big court system statewide, then the Judicial Council took over the Conference of Chief Judges, and they are now the policymaker for the court system statewide. And the policies that they set are the policies that the employees are required to follow. And the policies that they have set are in conflict with the statute. And so, and that's just how it sort of evolved. That's where we are now.
And Representative Drazkowski, this is an ongoing issue. Obviously, the policy-making body for the state of Minnesota is the Minnesota legislature and law signed by the governor. I imagine when the court system was founded at statehood, there weren't judges that wanted to be part of making policy for the courts. They left it up to us. But as the system has gotten a lot bigger and more sophisticated, they want to make their own policy, and they do it through the judicial council. And at times, there are questions about whether what they do meets the expectations of or comports with the limits of separation of powers. But we do the same thing. We tell the courts what they can do and can't do, and sometimes it's procedural and probably blurs the line. Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that there are also others in the audience that wish to testify.
Okay. Are there any, before that, are there any other questions from members for the testifiers who have testified so far? Seeing none, then, is there anyone from the audience who would like to be heard on this bill? Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Edward Reynoso. I'm the political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32. We are 100% supportive of this bill and its necessary changes to clean it up and make it, put it back, put it where it needs to be. So we're 100% supportive of it, just to be on the record.
Thank you for your testimony on that. Are there any questions for the testifier? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There actually is an A14 amendment that I'd like to draw the members' attention to. Members, this is an issue that we need to take a better look at. This is about, you know, we have real people who are doing court reportings, and as we transition to a lot of folks that are doing technology and automated court reporting, I think I just need to have a little bit more time looking at that particular issue, which is one of the reasons I want to lay the bill over so we have some time to work on it.
Great. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. So with there being nothing else, then, Chair lays the bill over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we just take House File 2687 quickly while you're still in the chair?
We can. Representative Hillstrom moves House File 2687 that it be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. And we have testifiers, Judge Susan Miles. You have no amendments to this bill, Representative Hillstrom?
I do not.
Okay, then to your bill, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, this was brought to me through the district judges, and so I'm going to let them testify about what the bill is and what it does.
Okay, Judge Miles, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Susan Miles, and I am past president of the Minnesota District Judges Association and chair of its Board on Judicial Standards Committee. I'm chambered in Stillwater, which is within the 10th Judicial District, and have been a district judge for over 17 years. Also appearing with me today is Nancy Haas, Legislative Counsel for the Minnesota District Judges Association. The bill before you today, House File 2687, codifies an administrative procedure which has been in place within the judicial branch for more than 6 years. Let me be clear from the start. MDJA does not object at all to the enforcement of what we refer to as the 90-day rule. That rule provides that a judge has 90 days in which to issue a written order in any case that has been submitted to him or her for decision. The issue which we are attempting to address with House File 2687 is, first, whether the purpose of the enforcement mechanism should be punitive or remedial, and second, the most effective enforcement mechanism. The answer to each of these questions differs depending on whether or not the infraction is isolated or as part of a pattern of habitual tardiness rising to the level of misconduct. But first, let me speak to the proposed deletion at lines 1.11 through 1.14, which would eliminate notice to the Commissioner of Management and Budget and the resulting withholding of pay from a recalcitrant judge. Should have used a 25-cent word instead of a 50. This is a hammer that has never been used before because the time necessary to deploy it is so protracted that by the time the Office of Management and Budget can be notified, the lapse will have been cured. I've heard a rumor that there is an effort to clear the books of ineffective and outdated statutes, part of something I think I just heard referred to as the uncession, and I'd like to nominate this particular provision for inclusion in that category. Besides, withholding of a judge's pay for a violation of the 90-day rule is obviously a punitive measure, And as I intend to point out now, isolated violations are more appropriately dealt with at the local level with the purpose of rectifying the conditions which caused the violation. For minor, isolated, or inadvertent infractions of the 90-day rule, a remedial approach should be employed. Pursuant to existing judicial council policy, the chief judge of the district is charged with responsibility to consult with a judge who has failed to decide a case within 90 days and must, within 30 days, resolve the infraction with that judge. The chief judge and the affected district judge can identify the source of the problem and remedy the cause. Most often, it is simply a computer entry problem, though sometimes it could stem from illness of the judge or an unanticipated family emergency. Should a second violation occur within 5 years of the first, the chief and the judge are tasked with developing a written plan to avoid future infractions. The bill before you specifies what the written plan must include. If the judge refuses to follow the plan or if there is a third violation in 5 years, then the matter is appropriately referred to the Board on Judicial Standards for treatment as an ethics violation, as by now the situation has become serious and persistent. In advocating for this bill, the Minnesota District Judges Association in no way wishes to detract from the professionalism of the Minnesota Board on Judicial Standards. But in the 45 years since Section 546.27 was originally enacted, much has changed. First, the administrative oversight of judges within their districts has been formalized and vastly improved. Chief judges can deal with a 90-day violation immediately after its occurrence, in contrast with the Board on Judicial Standards, which meets only 10 times per year. Second, weekly computerized reports now keep chief judges and district administrators abreast of each judge's entire under-advisement caseload and is not limited to reporting situation in which 90 days has been exceeded. Given the availability of these reports, these officials can and do intercede with the judge and provide assistance before violations occur. Third, the Board on Judicial Standards now has oversight over more than 300 judges and referees, freeing the Board on Judicial Standards from the administrative burden of monitoring compliance with the 90-day rule would permit it to devote its resources to more serious rule violations. Finally, elevating a first or second time violation of the 90-day rule to the level of an ethics violation is a very harsh consequence for most situations in which the breach is a result of simple oversight or emergency. Enactment of this bill would codify existing judicial council policy and would formalize the practice of channeling 90-day rule violations to where they can be dealt with most effectively on the administrative level. Thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony, Judge Miles. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Judge, thank you for being here with us today and testifying. The Board on Judicial Standards is tasked with taking action on any judge that's 90 days over. And I'm just curious what that action might be, if you happen to know.
Judge Miles.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that action would include private admonition and or a public reprimand. These are the formal tools that are available to them. They could handle it on an informal level. The executive secretary could call the judge in question and say, what's going on anyway? But in the meantime, the chief judge of the district has already handled it. But directly to your point, private admonition or public reprimand.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the testifiers or the bill's author? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Judge Miles. Originally, when this law was written, it appears that there was a desire to have a more punitive approach for these judges, and now we're moving to something that essentially would give them up to five years from their first infraction before the formal review would actually kick in. Does that remove it too far? I mean, do you have cases of judges that how many judges would fall into this on a given time within the state?
Judge Miles.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Very good question. In the one instance that comes to recent mind, the board can and did intercede well before 5 years went by. There was a case in which a judge on the workers' sorry, the tax court did receive public discipline, and it was within about 2 years after the situation first arose. That entire two-year period was consumed with investigations and formal proceedings and back and forth and response and hearings, and it took them that long to deal with the infraction. But the board did jump in and intercede when they became aware of the problem, and that was a persistent violation situation.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Judge Miles, what does, for those of us that don't hang around the court regularly, what does that public reprimand mean to a judge?
Judge Miles.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a career killer, basically. I mean, we stand for election every 6 years, and if you've been publicly reprimanded, then that's like red meat thrown out there for anybody who would want to come and challenge a judge, and they will rise up and run against a judge in the popular election. It is also fuel for enhancing future disciplinary matters against that particular judge. It's very serious. The judges take it very seriously. They take private admonitions very seriously as well.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Judge Miles. I feel much better about the bill now.
Any other questions from members? Seeing none, then Representative Hillstrom has moved that House File 2687 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
Representative Portman moves that House File 2213 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Portman, welcome. Please state your name and go ahead.
Thank you. Members, House File 2213 was brought to me by the Legal Aid Society. It has broad support across the spectrum. And here to present the bill is Ron Elwood from the Legal Aid Society.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Members, this is a small technical bill with very large implications for assuring the marketability of title and the buying of and selling of homes in Minnesota. This bill is before you because there have been a couple of recent Minnesota Court of Appeals and Minnesota Supreme Court's decisions regarding the interpretation of certain foreclosure statutes, which do not have an impact on the sections in this bill, but if you connect some legal dots, could potentially call into question whether or not the statute of limitations for bringing claims for defective foreclosures is still effective. And when we got together with the Minnesota Bankers Association, the Real Property Section of the Minnesota State Bar Association, the Association of Realtors, the Minnesota Credit Unions, the Independent Bankers of Minnesota, and started talking about this, we all thought that it would be a good idea to ask you to clarify and make clear, well, it's the same thing, sorry, to clarify that the statute of limitations is inviolate. And so that's really what this bill does. It just reaffirms, it's a preventative bill that reaffirms and strengthens the longstanding Minnesota statute that sets the time beyond which you can no longer make a claim for a defective foreclosure. And why that's so critical is this. That allows title companies to issue title insurance. It allows lenders to lend. It allows realtors to broker real estate transactions. And most importantly, it allows homeowners and buyers to sell and buy homes with confidence. And so, members, that is, as I mentioned before, we have worked with the Real Property Section of the Bar, the Minnesota Bankers Association, the Minnesota Association of Realtors, the Minnesota Title Association, Minnesota Credit Union Network, and the Independent Bankers of Minnesota, all supporting this bill, all collaborating together to bring this forward to you. And I would just point out there are two sections to the bill. The guts of the bill is in Section 2, but Section 1, just to point out, we did, Representative Portman last year carried the foreclosure bill that passed with bipartisan support, I think it was unanimous, in the House. And one of the things we did last year was to provide a small exemption for small banks, credit unions, community banks, and that was a temporary exemption, and we're simply making that permanent, and that's what Section 1 does. And I'm happy to stand for questions.
Questions from members? All right, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Hortman renews her motion that House File 2213 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
The final bill on the calendar is Representative Schoen. Is he here? Well, Representative Schoen is making it down. Can I get a motion on the minutes? I have the minutes from March 5th.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Lean moves the minutes from March 5th. Any errors or corrections? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. I have the minutes from March 4th. Representative Lean?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right. Any errors or corrections? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And the final set of minutes is from Wednesday, February 26th.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Any errors or corrections? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Schoen, I will move that House File 2307 be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance Committee. I believe you have an author's amendment labeled the A3 amendment. Members, this technically came in this afternoon. I knew that it was coming, so I didn't actually have the language within the 24 hours, but I believe that this is actually a compromise amendment that makes everyone a lot happier. So if no one objects to it, I'd like to move the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Schoen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Every one of the districts that we represent has been adversely affected by the tragedies related to opiate-based painkiller and heroin overdoses. Some of you may have neighbors and loved ones who have succumbed to the perils of addiction. Over the years, many have become reliant on opiate-based painkillers like oxycodone. Many have graduated to heroin when they can no longer obtain or afford the prescription-based opiates. Minnesota has the dubious distinction of having some of the purest heroin in the country. As a result, it also has some of the deadliest. An addict will not know from time to time how pure the heroin they are injecting into their arm is. It's easy for many in society to cast aside those with these addictions and not want to help them. I've had the fortune or misfortune in many circumstances to get to know those addicted to opiates in my work as a police detective working on the narcotics task force. These people really do come from every community, every age range, and every walk of life. I've dealt with high school kids, law school students, medical professionals, and millionaires. Most were far from the homeless, disheveled stereotype portrayed in movies. In this bill, I'm asking you to allow law enforcement, first responders, and others who would be well positioned to help those in an overdose situation be able to provide a safe antidote which can reverse the deadly effects of an opiate overdose immediately. This will save lives. In the clearest explanation, this would allow responders, such as law enforcement officers, to carry with them on patrol. In some parts of the state, law enforcement and first responder units can be 10 to 20 minutes ahead of the ambulance crew. The ability to administer this medication in the case of a heroin or opiate-based painkiller overdose will be the difference between life and death. This could be a heroin user or one of your children who recently had surgery and accidentally overdosed on a painkiller. If I'm in Representative McNamer's district, there are some vast areas, and really what this works out to is that the sheriff in your county, Representative McNamer, can now carry an extremely safe overdose as they could in Representative Draskowski's district as well, too. This antidote, quite frankly, is equal. I don't want to say it's equal to water, but it's not addictive. It's not anything that takes a lot of extra training. It can be injected into the nose through a nasal spray, and it will absolutely save lives. Probably the biggest piece that we're focusing on here today is Section 4, and quite frankly, it initially contained a language that had a immunity from prosecution for those that called for help and the person that was that needed help. There's merit to that. That is a good part of the bill that but needed more discussion, and we just couldn't find common language to keep this from not being controversial. We had a lot of discussion about this last year related to a bill that I co-sponsored related to alcohol overdose in the case of a party. So the discussion point there is we did come up with a resolution on language there that provided some immunity. However, that's a status offense. And once somebody turns 21, it's not illegal anymore. This is a felony all the time. And so that has been our most difficult point. So this amendment that we moved creates some comfort language, and what we're trying to do is guide county prosecutors into the direction when it is related for someone calling for help. We really want you to take a very strong look at using immunity, as using your prosecutorial discretion. In the case that somebody did call for help, because a life is more valuable than sending someone to jail.
Questions from members? Testifiers?
We do have some testifiers in the audience, Madam Chair.
Representative Scott has a question first.
And this probably is probably out of the purview of this committee, but I'm just curious, this antidote, I know that heroin and oxycodone and those repress your respiratory system, so is this kind of like an upper kind of a thing, or what does it do physiologically to save the person?
Representative Schoen.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Scott, now, I didn't bring, since we discussed this in Health and Human Services, I didn't bring Cody Weiberger, a doctor, to give you the best explanation, but it's an antidote. So the best thing that I could say is if in the case you get a bee sting and you give Benadryl or something like that, well, maybe there is somebody. You know what? We do have a doctor here, I think. He can give you a better explanation.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman and committee members and Representative Schoen. My name is Dr. Gavin Bart. I am Director of Addiction Medicine at Hennepin County Medical Center and also have a PhD in experimental and clinical pharmacology. So these are questions I feel I can answer. Opioids suppress breathing and have their effect through specific receptors in the brain and throughout the body. Naloxone is a completely non-abusable substance that binds to those exact same receptors, but it binds to those receptors very tightly and will basically remove any opiate that is on those receptors, so then those opiates can no longer have an effect. It lasts about 40 minutes, and it acts immediately. And so within a minute or two after receiving naloxone, all opioid effects disappear and the breathing is restored.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Schoen.
Representative Scott or anybody on the committee, if you have a relative that has diabetes and you've seen them go to have low blood sugar and then you give them more sugar and then they snap out of it, it's literally like that. I've been using this professionally since 1996 and have saved lives with it, and it's fantastic, and it's safe.
Questions from members? All right, to your testifiers, Representative Schoen. I think Dr. Bart was going to be one of the testifiers.
I will sign this later. So, again, I'm Gavin Bart at Hennepin County Medical Center and also on the board of directors for the American Society of Addiction Medicine, and I would like to advocate for this bill that includes both the provision of naloxone to peace officers throughout the state and to the lay public. As it currently stands, naloxone can only be used in hospital settings and by advanced life support, so not even average ambulances can carry this, only advanced life support as it stands right now. So this bill is necessary to get the antidote into the hands of people who need it, especially in rural areas where it may be a long time before advanced life support can arrive, but police could arrive quickly. Additionally, we must look at when overdoses occur. Now, overdoses occur not just in drug addicts, but in all kinds of people, people receiving opioids for pain medication, for pain issues. When overdoses occur, they can occur in public places, they can occur in private places. The situations in which deaths occur most frequently are when they occur in private places. And why is that? Well, in public places, an individual walking down the street may be able to see someone who's not breathing or not aroused, and they can call 911 and get on with their day. In a private setting, people are often very afraid of calling 911. In fact, when surveyed, whether it's in Australia, whether it's in New York City, whether it's in San Francisco, people who've been faced with overdoses in private situations, 50% of them will say they do not call 911, and the number one reason they do not is for fear of prosecution. They do not want to get in trouble for this. So part and parcel of being able to make this antidote effective is we need to make those who are witnessing overdoses feel more comfortable that they will be safe if they call 911, that they will not be subject to prosecution. And I'm not so sure that having a purely mitigating factor within the bill would be enough to assuage those people who are fearing the loss of their Section 8 housing because they called 911, who are afraid because they may have some pills in their pocket that weren't prescribed to them that they will go to jail and therefore don't call 911. We have experience with many patients and many people who describe not calling 911 because of this. Interestingly, you know, addiction is one of these areas that has a medical problem but an overlap with criminal justice. And since this is the Judicial Committee, I thought I would relate to you that as recently as yesterday, the Department of Justice and Attorney General Eric Holder announced their support for the wide distribution of naloxone, and in their report from the Department of Justice website say, quote, in concert with Good Samaritan laws, which grant immunity from criminal prosecution to those seeking medical help for someone experiencing an overdose, naloxone can save lives. So notice it says, in concert with Good Samaritan. We can't have one without the other. And this is coming directly from the Department of Justice. So I would hope that this committee also sees the wisdom of needing to provide both components of this bill together to help save the lives of our citizens here in Minnesota and throughout the country. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Your next testifier. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, Representative Schoen. My name is Lexi Reed Holtum. I am Vice President of the Steve Remler Hope Foundation, and I am Chair of the coalition that is supporting Representative Schoen in bringing this bill forward to you. So I wanted to let you know right up front that we do have the support for both sides of the bill from the ACP, the MMA, DHS, MDH, Poison Control, the Coalition of Recovery Investment, the Minnesota AIDS Project, the Minnesota Chapter of American College of Emergency Physicians, and the Minnesota Ambulance Association. So that's a lot of people who have a lot more knowledge around this issue than I do. I am a layperson who has fallen into knowledge of this epidemic because of my circumstances. My fiancé and my first love, we were each other's first loves in high school and college, and then came back together again in our 40s, was Steve Remler, the namesake of this bill. He's also the namesake of the Steve Remler Hope Foundation, which I'm vice president of. So Steve was a pretty much an all-American man. I mean, we grew up in Edina. He graduated from the University of Minnesota. He was a top financial planner in Eden Prairie. We had an exceptional life, and he had everything to live for: family, extended family, means. And we live in Minnesota, where he had some of the best medical care possible. Steve experienced a back injury from the back injury. He had spinal pain. Years into his spinal pain, his very well-intended doctors prescribed him opioids. Very shortly after being prescribed opioids, he developed dependence on it, and then he slipped into the disease of addiction. 5 years after starting his opioid treatment for his pain, he ended up going to treatment for addiction. He completed the treatment successfully upon being released from treatment. He had, this was when hydrocodone combination products were still Schedule 3, and he had refills at the pharmacy. He picked up the refills, he went through the refills when he relapsed, and then he ran out and turned to someone that he had met that could get him heroin. He had no other choice of how to receive opioids. Doctors were no longer willing to prescribe. And actually, in Steve's 5 years of being prescribed opioids, he doctor shopped and found an unethical doctor who prescribed him any amount of opioids or any other drug that he wanted in any form and any amount. That doctor, while Steve was in treatment, surrendered his license to practice because the DEA was bringing a case against him. So this is how Steve came into the disease of addiction, a man who was exceptional and very intelligent and probably a lot like the people that we know in our families, right? So he's not the typical picture of what you'd look like. And I would pose to you all that addiction looks like Steve. And it's not the street person. And the number one cause of accidental death in our country today is from prescription opioids. That said, there are 14 other states that have implemented Good Samaritan laws, and there are 17 other states that have implemented naloxone laws. So we've got to stack a body of evidence that's already provided for us as to the effectiveness of this. And I'm just going to quickly let you know that I did provide for you the statistics of what the bills look like in each state. And that is this information. So you can see which states provided what as far as immunity and mitigating factors. I wanted to use the example of Washington since they were so inclusive, and they also have been around since 2008. Their bill has been around since then. In 2011, the University of Washington Alcohol and Drug Abuse Institute published initial evaluation results. Their analysis included interviews of opioid users, police, paramedics in Seattle. The report cited no negative consequences to date. Only about one-third of the opioid users surveyed were aware of the immunity provisions, but having been made aware, 88% that said that they would be more likely to call 911 in an emergency overdose situation. Knowledge of the immunity provisions was also sketchy among law enforcement and law enforcement personnel, who said arrests and overdose situations were uncommon anyway. Prosecutions, therefore, were not being impeded under the immunity law, the report says. So to conclude, I just wanted to let you know that there were three people with Steve when he overdosed. We're well aware of that fact. There was a case brought against them. I mean, there wasn't ever a case brought against them because they cannot prove without a shadow of a doubt when what happens is somebody overdoses and people are fearful, so they clean the scene and leave. And that is exactly what happened in Steve's case. That is exactly what has happened in numbers of cases of the constituents across the state who are supporting this bill have seen happen to their loved ones, is that people clean the scene and abandon the person out of fear. We are posing that it would be much more effective if we remove the fear, then there would be no death. So that's what we're proposing, and I thank you very much for your time. If you have any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Schoen, your next testifier. I believe Sheriff Stanek. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Rich Stanek. I'm the sheriff in Hennepin County. Thank you for taking the time to let us talk to you this afternoon about this important piece of legislation. I want to thank Representative Schoen as well. You know, great leadership in bringing this forward to help first responders statewide with you know, what could very well be a life-saving antidote and save many, many lives across the state. The statistics in and of themselves are alarming. If you looked at the chart over here, you'll see just in Hennepin County alone, you know, we're about 22% of the state's population, but back in 2010 when we started to see heroin and opiate-based overdose deaths, we had 8 of them. And now last year in 2013, we ended up with 56. So far this year in 2014, I've had 9 deaths in my county in the first 2 months compared to 3 deaths in 2013 during those first 2 months. So you can see why it's of great concern to law enforcement. Most of today's heroin users, as the representative said, start out as with prescription pain medication, or about 80% of them abused painkillers. These painkillers have been prescribed by a doctor for severe pain management after maybe a knee surgery or a back injury. What Deputy Myrie is posting up on the board there are some samples of heroin. We thought you might like to see what it looks like. You see it's packaged really cute, right? They got balloons, they've got little bindles. That's about $60,000 worth of street value heroin, which is why he's here, and he's going to keep track of it during the committee hearing. But this is important stuff. Many folks, like we said, 4 out of 5 start out with prescription pain pills, and then they turn to heroin. Heroin is cheap, it's easy to get, the purity is extremely pure, and it's unforgiving. You never know how much of it you're going to get when you ingest it, inject it, and take it orally, take it nasally, you name it. It's much more invasive than it was 20, 25 years ago when you used to have to tie off your arm, heat up into a liquid substance, put it into a needle, and inject it into your arms. Today, kids are doing it much easier than that, and that's why we're having the exponential increase in overdose deaths. We think from law enforcement across the board, Minnesota Sheriff's Association, and friends in law enforcement statewide believe that Narcan and Naloxone, Narcan by trade name, will help us. We've seen great results. Did you talk about Quincy or the other two cities? You know, we looked at Quincy, Massachusetts, Madam Chair and members. They had 188 heroin overdose reversals since 2010. 188 people whose lives were saved because they were able to get this at the scene by their first responders. Now, paramedics in Minnesota, like Dan and others, can administer this. Cops like myself and our firefighters and most of the EMTs who operate in greater Minnesota cannot. What you'll be doing here with Dan's bill is changing state law to allow that to happen. You get the same thing in Suffolk County, New York, where 108 reversals, that's another 108 lives saved. Minnesota will not be alone, Madam Chair and members. 17 other states and the District of Columbia have already passed legislation like this. And so we're asking, give us a chance, give first responders a chance to save folks out at the scene. Those 25, 30, 35, 40 minutes, as the doctor testified to, means all the difference in the world.
Thank you. Representative Schoen, any further testify?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there was one more on the bill, or one more on the list. Thank you, Sheriff.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Michonne Jenkin, and I am here today because I lost my only child, my beautiful 29-year-old daughter, Ashley. And this happened June 22nd of 2013. She was tragically taken from this world because 911 was not called in time of her critical need for help. The person at her side was on probation and did not call 911 because he was worried about the implications of making that call. He instead let her die. Her lifeless body lay on the floor between 4 and 6 hours before he mustered up the courage to finally call 911. Ironically, the day before my daughter lost her life, she made a 911 call to save his. He had overdosed on heroin and was taken to the hospital and lived in spite of this glaring example of her call to 911 to save his. He was too fearful to make that call to save hers. Unfortunately, Ashley suffered from the disease of addiction. I'm not certain when her addiction started. I know she was prescribed Xanax because she had anxiety over flying. And again, I think her addiction really was getting bad when she was involved with this person she became involved with. Her addiction, however, did not define her. She was much more than that. Ashley grew up in a very close, loving family that simply put, adored her. She was the center of our lives. She was a daughter, a granddaughter, a niece, a cousin, a friend, and we were all blessed to have her in our lives. She loved her family, her friends, children, and animals. She grew up as a bright, inquisitive, animated child. Most importantly, we remember her for the beautiful woman she became. Compassionate, caring, loving, vibrant, energetic, always smiling. She was a volunteer. She worked full time. She worked the day before she lost her life. She was a gifted massage therapist. Her clients described her as a beautiful person inside and out, the bright spot in their day, sweet and caring, and the best therapist they had ever been to. She was always on the leaderboard as top requested therapist where she worked. Ashley loved her profession and the healing she provided for them. She loved nature, camping, knitting, crafting. She dreamt of having a family and children of her own. She had a passion for life that was evident to all of us that were blessed to have her in our lives. The same individual that was unable to call 911 at the time of Ashley's death had a history of not calling 911. 3 months before Ashley died, I was out of town in Florida, and I received a phone call from him that Ashley was in trouble, that he thought she may have overdosed. He called his mother. His mother told him to call me, and he called me. I kept him on the phone while my sister, who was at my side, called 911. I was 2,000 miles away, and the helplessness of not being able to get the help my daughter needed was horrible. After being hospitalized, the physicians caring for Ashley and I began the process for chemical dependency treatment assistance. Ashley was ultimately denied that assistance and was released without the real help she needed. She died within 3 months of that day. Addiction is a disease. It's not a moral failing. It has no boundaries. And like many other diseases, it's treatable. It is treatable. We have an opportunity here today to make a difference. I am asking you, pleading with you, to take this opportunity and to make the right decision and support the 911 Good Samaritan plus naloxone bill so that we can save lives. I believe that my beautiful daughter, Ashley, would be alive today had this bill been in place, and we have an opportunity to do that, to save lives. This bill is about saving lives. And 911 needs to be a part of that. If somebody doesn't call 911, they're not going to get the naloxone they need. And with that being said, I all hope you will take this into consideration.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Sean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And you know, to clarify, oh, is there?
Representative Paymer.
Yeah.
I just have a question when we're done.
And Representative Sean. So, Madam Chair and members, you know, the biggest part that they're here advocating for is the part that we amended out of the bill. And I, you know, we don't prosecute many of these cases. I don't know that I've talked to any prosecutor that has in recent time where somebody called for help. And so then you'd think, well, if that's the case, why not just put up immunity so that we can let people know, don't worry, you're not going to get prosecuted anyway. Kind of wish we could, but we don't have that. We don't have the votes for it right now. We don't have we just can't make it happen. And so that's why you have the language before you today in that portion of the bill for the immunity part that says we really want prosecutors to make sure that, you know, if they do call for help, that you'll use immunity or at least use your discretion to use that as a mitigating factor and to make that happen. So I appreciate your support on the bill. I think I wasn't sure if it was going to public safety, but evidently that's next, and I'm not sure if there's other paths for that. And there is a different bill in the Senate. It's not completely the same as it stands today.
I believe that there's someone else in the audience that may wish to testify for or against this bill. Is there anyone in the audience? Please come forward, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I'd also like to thank my representative, Cindy Pugh. I've met with her a couple times about this, so thank you all. My name is Jenny McCourt, and I'm here to tell you why House File 2307 should become law in Minnesota. And I've never done this before, so I'm nervous.
Everybody, we're all the same.
Thank you. First thing I want to tell you is that I'm a mom. And I'm a mom of a recovering addict, which also means I'm the mom of a child with a chronic, life-threatening illness. I want to tell you a little bit about our family. We're normal, as much as anyone could say that. My husband was an executive for a Fortune 500 company. I stayed home to raise our two kids. I was president of the elementary PTO. I volunteered on various boards, including chair of the Chanhassen unit of Operation Minnesota Nice, where we gathered care packages for soldiers. As my children were growing, I was trying to be the best role model I could. We did normal stuff. My husband and I spent thousands and thousands of hours in the car taking our kids to various sports practices, even to the point where asked where I live, I'd say, in a white minivan. We spent all sorts of time with our extended family. We did our best to raise a good family. Despite all this, drug abuse and drug addiction happened to our family. It's devastating to watch your child become someone you don't understand, watch them behave in ways that you cannot comprehend. I have become a reluctant expert in drug abuse and drug addiction, as has Michonne, as has Corinne, as has Lexi. We didn't want to become experts, but we are now. And so we ask that, as the experts that we are, that you listen to us, and as the experts like the MMA and all the other organizations that Lexi listed off that are in support of both sides of this bill, we ask that you listen to them and use your influence with other members and tell them how important this immunity piece is. I also ask that even though my voice is shaking and that even though Michonne was emotional, that you not discount our passion. Really, quite the opposite. I hope that you can see that we can have a perspective and a uniquely dispassionate perspective because we've had to face the worst. I've gone to the fear of losing my child. Other parents here have gone to the darkest place and actually faced that loss. And so we feel as experts now in this way that we can say we need something different. The numbers that Sheriff Stanek told you, showed you show us that prosecuting and arresting is not the way out of this epidemic. That's what we've been doing. We need change. We need to do something new. That's why we're proposing this bill. The old way is increasing these numbers exponentially. The new way might be a way out. The way the experts like us who have seen this can say, this could change. We're not going to arrest our way out of this epidemic. If my child who is in recovery right now relapses, I'm sure it will be with a friend. I hope that relapse doesn't happen, but the statistics are grim. I'm sure it will be with someone. And when someone relapses, they're much more sensitized, and so the dosage will probably be different, and the risk is very high. I want very much for whoever is with my child to be able to call 911 without fear, to not have to take the time to clean up the scene, to save those precious moments and make a difference. And I want that for every other addict and user in Minnesota. It is a chronic disease. So I'll just end with, we don't give up on people when their cancer returns. We don't give up on people with chronic diseases. We might get angry with them if they behave in unhealthy ways again and their cancer comes back because of that, but we don't give up on them and we don't arrest them. So please take both sides of this bill into consideration. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, I was just going to suggest if it, now that the amendment has gone on and it's now permissive, and I'm just not sure that we needs to make a stop at the policy committee, public safety policy committee, so might want to just move it to the floor.
Okay. Representative Walsh?
It needs to go to civil law.
Okay. So the motion then would be, I would move that House File 2307 as amended.
Wait.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Schoen, thank you for, I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. This is a couple issues that I've seen just looking at this and speaking of somebody that has an addiction problem in their family and have dealt with it for close to 20 years. I understand the suffering that the families go through and the difficulties that they have. Last year was the first year that we actually had alcohol consumption and medical emergencies involving that had an immunity from prosecution. Before we do more of that, personally, I would like to see what that has done and how that, if that has actually helped. But I understand the need for it. I've yet to ever prosecute somebody or have filed the charges with the county attorney's office for somebody that has as narcotics in their system. Because if it's in their system, technically you can't charge them for that unless it's a driving offense.
only on possession, because so if it's in their system, prosecutors can't really charge him for that offense. But the main concern I have is how this bill is written. Is we could, as law enforcement, we could go to the scene, give the drugs to help that person out, and look over in the corner and see 2 or 3 kilos of heroin. And by the way this bill is written, we could not seize that. Because in this bill on line 4.7 and 4.8, from 4.6, person who experienced alcohol or drug overdose and is in need of medical assistance may not be arrested, charged, prosecuted, penalized, or have their personally property subject to civil forfeiture. By taking that, you're civilly forfeiting it, which would be in violation of the statute. So I think that needs to be tweaked a little bit so we can get that drugs off the street.
Madam Chair.
Representative Schoen.
And Representative Johnson, the A3 amendment did exactly that. It deleted the entire section that you referred to, and it replaced it with some language that I wish could be stronger towards the immunity side, but it basically leaves prosecutorial discretion. And so that language replaces that entire section saying, listen, prosecutors, we really, really, as a legislature, want you to really think about this before you prosecute, because people are trying to help people. That's really what's going on here. And I worked with Ramsey County Attorney John Choi and Washington County Attorney Pete Orpit to kind of come up with the language that we have here. And if we could do better, I would love to see some better, but we just haven't had the input and the ability to find common ground on this that would get us to get this stuff in the hands of law enforcement and first responders. We were able to amend the bill in health, which took care of getting it into our BLS ambulance services that can't have it now, and so we've done some work to make it better, and this is making it passable.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Schoen, for bringing the bill and for the amendment. I think this helps the bill move much more expeditiously. Just kind of a general question as I read the bill, I'm trying to understand. Now, talking with you earlier, it sounds like this Narcan stuff is, I mean, I think you said it's like water. It's not anything that's, are there any downsides to this stuff? It sounds like it could be even made more ubiquitous than the bill does now. I mean, we've got defibrillators, you know, parked out at places and public places for people just to use when they need to use them. Does this allow that type of, access, or is it, I see some specified people in the bill that can actually have this stuff, or maybe that's a next step down the road in the future. I was just curious quickly on your thoughts.
Well,
Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair and members, I think long-term my thoughts are, let's say you go to the doctor and you get prescribed OxyContin, I can see a day that they'll also prescribe this antagonist, an opiate antagonist, to send out. There may be a day and a time when this is next to the fire extinguisher and the AED, and maybe there's a vial of nasally injected Narcan, but probably not. You do need a slight amount of training and medical oversight to do so. And that's where we're at, and that's what this would do. If there's, oh, I thought that was somebody else coming up to answer, but no, it's really safe.
Further questions from members? All right, seeing none, the chair recommends that House File 2307 be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Schoen. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
With that, members, this meeting is adjourned.